It's a great day for baseball. Let's play two. The late, great Ernie Banks made that remark during his baseball career. No word on what his teammates thought of the idea. The baseball season goes on for a long time. 162 games in the regular season, more in the playoffs if your team is good. Today's guest covers sports for a living, and he noticed baseball players talking about the requirements that all those games and the very few days off place upon bodies and minds. His book title is the term the players use, The Grind. Barry Svrluga is a Washington Post reporter, been there since 2003. He's actually the beat reporter for the Washington Redskins in the NFL. But his previous beat was reporting on and blogging about the Nationals, the former Montreal Expos for you old-timers. He wrote the book National Pastime about the franchise's history, and he's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Barry, welcome.
Jeffrey, thanks for having me.
You make a great point at the start. As fans, we don't quite get what the effect is on the players and the teams. When did you realize this?
Well, I think it's easy, and it's not anybody's fault that fans don't really get it. I mean, this is, you know, a baseball season is really kind of a summer-long reality show. You sit down at 7 o'clock if you've got a team that you're really intensely interested in, and you follow them for 3 hours, and when it's over, you maybe watch the post-game show and break it down, but you click it off, and you start your day again the next day and think about all these other things before you tune in again. The players and everybody around them don't have that opportunity. They are consumed by the schedule. They are, in a lot of ways, it defines their existence. I mean, they wake up every day with a game right at their feet. That's not that different for other pro athletes. What's different is that when they're done with that one, the next one is coming right around the corner. So it's a very, very odd existence that dictates their family life. It dictates all their personal life, their decisions, how they conduct their day, what the flow, what their rhythms are, all that stuff. It's really inescapable and much different than other sports.
I must admit, I've just become aware in the last couple of years, and I've been a baseball fan since age 10, Mets fan, sorry, there are situations like when you're playing a night game and it's the last game of the series, and then you got to be on a plane to the opposite coast of the country.
Yeah,
and then so situations like that where these guys hit the bed at sometimes 7:30 in the morning.
Yeah, it's very, very strange. And again, I think outside of what we see in that nightly performance window, you know, mostly, and this is changing some, but mostly teams will fly immediately after the last game of a series. And frequently that's to another city where another game awaits that very next day. So if it's a night game that finishes at 10 o'clock, you know, kind of in a normal time scale, you know, heaven forbid it goes to extra innings and runs to 11 or 11:30, and then you're getting to the airport at 12:30. And, you know, they really do put their head on the pillow quite frequently at 3 or 4 in the morning at a hotel in a new city, and then get up the next day to do it again. Some teams now, when there's cross-country flights that are scheduled, particularly from the East Coast to the West, the players will vote to fly on the next day, so effectively flying on the day of the game. The San Francisco Giants have done this a couple times this year, flying from New York and from Washington back to San Francisco after a night game where they've had to play the day that they land. It's not a complaint as much as it is a reality, and there's no way that it doesn't have those kinds of things don't have an impact on how they perform and how they feel.
You know, you point out in the book that the baseball schedules were once arranged around the slower pace of train travel, one more reason to like train travel. And I'm just kind of shocked at the number of games played in some of the first professional seasons back in the 19th century.
Yeah, you're really talking then at fewer than 100 games and you know, more days off than days on. Frequently, there would be 2 days off and then a game and then another day off. Really something that is completely foreign to a modern-day professional baseball player. These guys have one scheduled weekend per year, and that's at the per season. That's at the All-Star break when they have 3 or 4 days off in a row. Never during the season from April to October are there scheduled back-to-back days off. So again, that just it creates a lifestyle that is very, very different and has an impact on all aspects of their life.
if anybody who studies the baseball schedule on a regular basis knows that you might get a Monday off, you might get a Thursday off. The chance of getting both in the same week is really remote. And at 162 games, it is a very action-packed schedule. Now, the old 154-game season from back in Babe Ruth days and up until expansion around 1960, was that just a multiple of the teams faced? Is that why they settled on 154 games?
Yeah, that's right. It was an even number of games against each opponent in kind of a round-robin format, and then when expansion came along, they increased it by 8 games to 162. I mean, interestingly enough, and this has happened since I kind of delved into the reporting for this project, which was, began at last January 2014. Since then, Rob Manfred has taken over from Bud Selig as the commissioner, and Manfred is a guy who's been in the game a long time, but really seems open to a lot of new ideas. And one of the things he kind of floated early in his tenure was, should we go back to 154 games? Are we asking too much of these players? Is performance suffering because they do play so many games you talk about 162 games, that's in 183 days. So over 6 months, you're getting just 20 or so off days. And off days, you know, often they are filled with travel. And often late in the season, they are canceled as off days because you have to make up a game from earlier in the season that was rained out. So Manfred understands the demands on his players' time and wonders, should we be peeling this back? Should we go back to 154?
And he very quickly added the reasons that might not happen. We'll talk about those coming up. The Grind, Inside Baseball's Endless Season is the book. Barry Sreluga from the Washington Post is its author and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Barry and take your phone calls and emails as we talk Inside Baseball, Inside the Grind, as we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about baseball today and the long, long baseball season. How would you like it if your boss said you need to work 162 of the next 183 days and be sharp? You can't phone it in any of those days. Well, that's what Barry Sreluga's book, The Grind, is about, subtitled Inside Baseball's Endless Season. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the wear and tear on players, on families, on organizations. 800-838-3760 by phone anywhere in the listening area, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Barry, you were just talking about Rob Manfred, the baseball commissioner, suggesting maybe 150 games or somewhere in that range would be a good thing, but he immediately explained the dollar rationale for not doing that.
Yeah, at the All-Star game in Cincinnati earlier in July, he was asked about this by some of us baseball reporters, and there's a very real economic impact of going from 162 to 154 games, and that is you're cutting down your content, your how much product you have to offer. Each team would lose 4 home dates in that sort of arrangement, and that would have an impact not only on their revenue from the gate, but it would also have an impact on their television deals. It would be 8 fewer broadcasts, which is a lot fewer ads sold, and all that kind of thing. So I guess my point was that the higher ups in baseball understand that the schedule is an issue and that they're asking a lot of their players, and they're wondering about how to lessen that impact on them. But they're also dealing with some very major, significant economic issues. This is a $9 billion industry, and it didn't get that way by cutting back on its product.
I have to wonder if the players' union has weighed in on this. I mean, would they entertain what amounts to, I guess, a 2% pay cut to have 8 fewer dates?
I don't think that's how they would approach it. I mean, I think what we're going to see, rather a kind of cutback on the schedule and an elimination of games, is probably some tweaks. The travel has kind of gotten out of control in terms of there are fewer fewer trips that make sense for, say, an East Coast team. If the Mets are going out to the West Coast, they really should be playing the Giants, the Padres, and and the Dodgers.
Which they used to do,
order.
Yeah.
Yeah, they used to do that, and it makes sense. Right now, there are a lot more trips that are kind of hybrids. You maybe go from San Francisco to Colorado to Milwaukee, and that doesn't seem like a big deal, but when you're leaving time zones and playing games at different times, these guys are creatures of habit, and all those things can have an impact. So I think what you're going to see is a lot of discussion between the union and the league to address this by snipping at the corners rather than slicing into the entire schedule.
You have a bunch of good history lessons in here, and one of them is that that players weren't players year-round until about the 1970s or so. I mean, what did they used to do in the offseason?
Yeah, I mean, the guys had all sorts of jobs. Yogi Berra worked in a department store selling suits, and, every sort of blue-collar kind of mining or lumberjacking job to substitute teaching, all sorts of stuff, regular Joe kind of stuff. This book kind of starts out looking at a veteran player in his offseason. In this case, it was Nationals third baseman Ryan Zimmerman. He's now become the first baseman. But that was part of the point to get at what we don't see. And what we don't see is that Ryan Zimmerman and guys like him who have been in the league for a decade or more are taking time in January to build up their bodies, and it's a full-time job to build up their bodies because what they do in January is going to have an impact on how they perform in August and September when they don't have time to build their bodies, when they're trying to just maintain and not allow the season to completely eat them away. So there's no time for other jobs now. Obviously, there's no need because the money is so great, too. But spring training is long since gone from being a time to get into shape for the season. It's now a place you show up already in shape and ready to compete.
I did find myself fascinated by this particular part of the book, the idea that they really have to develop a lot of body mass as they start the season because they're going to lose it. They're going to lose weight as the season goes on, which then begs the question, why are people so hard on the likes of Pablo Sandoval and CeCe Sabathia when they show up large in spring training?
It's such a balance. I mean, you have to be big and healthy and in shape and kind of built so that you don't wear down. You can't be fat, and I think that's where these guys are athletes. I think sometimes people discount the physical nature of baseball and what it takes to perform physically over 3 hours every night and do it again. They are absolutely athletes. It is a demanding physical endeavor, and if you are out of shape, and there have been guys who have tried to play out of shape, it'll have an impact on your performance.
But there are those people who particularly will point to the outfielders and say, but they're just standing there.
Yes, that is a common refrain, and if you want to walk into a major league clubhouse and meander over to an outfielder and say, well, you're just standing there, be prepared for at the very least a big eye roll. Watch outfielders carefully before each pitch and watch them crouch down and anticipate a swing. I'm not saying that that's a physically demanding thing to do, but over 140 pitches in a game, there's an intensity and a focus there that's necessary to be a very good player. Guys who take plays off often get caught. The ball seems to find you when you're not paying attention to the degree that you need to be. And again, it's not just the standing there in the four at-bats in a given night. It's the repetition of that. It's the everydayness of that. That can be kind of suffocating because unlike the NFL, which we know to be brutal and violent and have a real physical toll that can hamper guys late in their lives, this isn't a crescendo, a build to one three-hour window on a Sunday with 6 days to recover. It's an everyday thing.
We are talking to Barry Svrluga from the Washington Post about his book about baseball and its long season, 162 games in 183 days. The book is called The Grind. Here is John and Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Barry Svrluga. John, go ahead. I'll put John back on hold. Let's go to Howard in Eureka. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, good morning. It's a understanding, of course, that there's so much big business and money involved in this, but nevertheless, so many of us still love this game, but the thing that as a former player and just a fan, the thing that that bothers a lot of us is the length of the season mostly comes down to the end of the season, the post game, which essentially in many cities it's almost wintertime. And it's a summertime game, you know, and when you get down to October and you have TV schedules and everything, and there's a lot of, it just seems so anticlimactic in that sense, where you got the pitchers desperately trying to keep their hands warm to throw the ball and just, so I'm just thinking, you know, the season should be shorter somewhere, at least when it comes down to postseason. And that would mean enormous changes, I understand, with the whole business aspect of it, and all the travel thing, all these things you're talking about come into play.
All right, thanks.
That seems to be an important thing.
All right, Howard, thanks for that. Appreciate it. Thoughts, Barry?
Yeah, I don't disagree at all. I think that, people are not accustomed to having the Fall Classic end in November, which it has on occasion and has actually been scheduled to now. But the flip side is, and the reason we're not going to see that part change, is when they added the wild card, that added a lot of interest in more markets as we went down into September. More and more cities and more teams were in contention for meaningful playoff spots, and that kept interest, attendance, ratings, all of the things that bring revenue into the sport up. They've added now a second wild card in each league, and that's the trickle-down has played out quite well. It's added meaning to winning the division, which had some intrigue at the end of the regular season, and again brings more cities and more teams into play. I don't think they're going to expand the postseason right now, but I can tell you they definitely are not going to contract it. It is too much of a boon for baseball.
But, you know, now that you mentioned, I just looked at MLB.com. The World Series is scheduled to begin 4 days before Halloween.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it's so incongruous for people who are used to, you know, in the old days, the World Series would be played at the beginning of October when it was just the winner of the American League and the winner of the National League. Baseball has such an attachment to its history and its traditions, and there is always a segment of the fan base that resists change. I completely understand that. I think the realities are they are going to set up their sport so that they are maximizing drama and therefore maximizing revenue.
And as a former TV promo guy, I can tell you that the World Series leaking into November puts you into November ratings for the Fox affiliates.
Sure,
which
absolutely.
Is just
that's
what they want.
Yep.
Right. Barry Svrluga is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, sports writer for the Washington Post. He's written a book about baseball's long season, 162 games in 183 days. It's called The Grind, Inside Baseball's Endless Season. Here's John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, I agree. I don't know how these guys, position players, infielders, and outfielders play for 6 months in a row playing every day. But what about pitchers? Is there any animosity between, you know, a typical pitcher like Hernandez with Seattle only pitches probably six times a month? Is there any way that, I mean, if I was running Seattle, I'd have him pitch, well, you can't pitch every day, but is there any animosity or any oddity? Because I don't even know what pitchers do the other 4 days when they don't play.
Which is well covered.
Anyway,
yeah.
Thanks,
John.
Thanks.
Yeah, this is, I mean, I think that's part of the aim of the book is to take different elements of a franchise and kind of section them off and shed some light on how each element takes care of the everydayness of the schedule. So the pitcher, the starting pitcher that I used was Doug Pfister, who's a veteran starter with the Nationals. And the point of that chapter is really to go through and say, look, these 4 days off in between starts, when you're starting every fifth day, which is the most common major league rotation, are not off days. There's a tremendous physical and mental preparation that goes in to that time in between starts. It's different for each guy, but in general, you know, as soon as the starting pitcher comes out of his game, he is doing a series of very intense exercises to kind of flush his system out, fully expend his body, running the next day, and then beginning the build to the next start. As to whether there's animosity between pitchers and everyday players, I do think, and I know some position players who kind of roll their eyes at pitchers and how they're kind of a little finicky and maybe a little bit different because they don't prepare the same ways that that position players do. But to say that those off days are actual off days is a misnomer, and I think the book shows you a little bit of what goes into a pitcher's preparation.
Well, besides, I challenge any right fielder in the game to fling a ball at 95 miles an hour 100 times.
Right, it's completely different job description. The different job description extends even to the relievers. There's a chapter on a reliever in the book as well, and that job is mentally and physically completely different than even a starting pitcher's job because, a starter knows that every fifth day he's going to be on the mound and get the ball and go out for his 100 pitches and try to win or lose try to win the game. A reliever shows up every day with no idea whether he's going to be completely off that night and really had no reason to prepare, or if he's going to be in the most intense pressure-packed situation, trying to get the final two outs in a one-run ball game with runners on second and third. So that's a very different mental and physical challenge as well.
There are some cases, though, where, like, if a reliever did a four-out save last night, he's probably not going to be available tonight, right?
Yeah, they know that kind of thing. I mean, guys, teams definitely try to stay away from relievers 3 days in a row, except in extreme situations, and they manage those innings. So, a few times in 162 games, a reliever might know, I'm not going tonight, but that's the exception, not the rule for sure.
All right, I want to make sure I'm not getting too inside baseball with some of these comments or four-out save and stuff like that. But, and I want to point out, too, that the book generally focuses on the team you covered, the Washington Nationals, and you look at people at a bunch of different levels of the organization and not just the on-the-field folks. Let's come back to an earlier square, though, here. And, again, we're talking to Barry Sverluger from the Washington Post about his book, The Grind, Inside Baseball's Endless Season. 162 games sounds like a lot, certainly in 183 days, as you characterized it. But compare that, like, okay, the NBA season is very long. So is the hockey season at 6 months also. But how many games did they play in those times?
Well, they play 82 games, and it's actually not as long. It's a little closer to 5 months than it is to six, those two seasons. And there's not a seven-week buildup at spring training. The playoffs can go longer. They can run close to 2 months. But in general, those seasons are a little bit different. An intense week for a basketball or a hockey team, and both those sports are obviously quite physically demanding. An intense week involves four games. And occasionally, they will play back-to-back nights in which they're traveling in between and have to play the next night. And that's a very, very difficult task. But I've been around those sports, and I've listened to conversations between hockey players and baseball players, and each kind of marvels at how the other does it. I know that some hockey players here in Washington can't imagine going out and doing this six or seven nights in a row, and that's a very, very common week for a baseball player. So they're apples and oranges, sure, because the demands are different, but it's I think all athletes would acknowledge that what the baseball player goes through specifically mentally to prepare each day is a very tough task.
So I counted it twice yesterday. If you're a wild card team and every series you win all your series, but they go to the maximum number of games, you get into playing 182 games to win the World Series, or lose it for that matter.
Yes, exactly. And that part, is really kind of outside the parameters. I mean, the postseason, I don't think anybody is really wound up about what the schedule is then, because one, there are off days, and you're not going to play 7 days in a row unless there's
True.
Some sort of weird rainout situation. So you've got a little bit of room to breathe. Plus, you're playing for the highest stakes, and that's the month that everybody who comes to spring training in the first or second week of February has their eye on. That's what their hopes are. That's really what they play for. So I think that's all joy. It doesn't become it's not that arduous. It's the reason they're in the game.
That's a real second wind kind of situation. I can get. Yeah. When we talk about the wear and tear on the body, but you get as you talk about Ryan Zimmerman, now the first baseman of the Washington Nationals. It's not just about the fact that he was trying to recover from injuries and surgery, but there was a mental toll there as well.
A huge mental toll. I mean, Ryan Zimmerman was a guy who was the fourth pick in the draft in 2005 out of the University of Virginia. he was in the major leagues at the end of that season and never went back to the minors. The game has always kind of come easily to him, and every franchise has somebody like that, somebody kind of the chosen one who was a first-round pick and has excelled at every level. So in 2014, when his shoulder was breaking down and he had no strength there, and he had been a Gold Glove third baseman but now could not throw the ball across the diamond accurately, and for the first time in his career was standing there on the field with 40,000 people in the stands and hundreds of thousands of more watching on TV in a late game situation, was hoping that the ball was not hit to him. That was completely foreign, and there's nowhere to hide in those situations because you don't have time to recover. You have to be out there the next night. You're a big part of this franchise in this town. That really takes a toll and causes doubt in a guy's mind, doubt that hasn't ever existed there before.
Truly the Grind, which is the name of Barry Svrluga's book, Inside Baseball's Endless Season. We'll come back and talk more with Barry and take more of your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for joining us. Our guest today is Barry Svrluga, sports writer for The Washington Post. He's put a book together about baseball and its six-month season, including 162 games, roughly twice as much as the nearest other sport. The book is called The Grind, Inside Baseball's Endless Season. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange by phone, 800-838-3760, with your questions and comments, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were talking about Ryan Zimmerman just now and his concern about trying to come back from injuries and surgery and being afraid of getting the ball hit to him because he might throw it away, and he did in a couple of circumstances, which makes me wonder then about the mental effect on other players, the Chuck Knobloch and the Mackie Sassers of the world who seem to forget how to throw the ball. I mean, is this part of what the grind does to them?
It can be. I mean, I think those are extreme situations. Zimmerman's case was really more physical than mm-hmm. mental. His shoulder had worn down over time and was not back from surgery. But as we were talking about, I mean, self-doubt is a big part of baseball. These guys come across as really kind of cocksure athletes and you know, very confident performers. But no sport is defined by failure as much as baseball is. I mean, we've heard it a million times, but a hitter who fails 7 times out of 10 is probably going to end up in the Hall of Fame. And that's how frequently that you have to deal with not succeeding in that job. So managing failure and understanding it and knowing that you're going to go through times in a season where you haven't had a hit in 4 days and does that affect your approach the next day? It shouldn't. It can't, because you really need to maintain kind of an even keel. But these guys are human, and failure affects psyches and affects approaches and really can get in the way of how these guys perform.
Which I imagine creates a lot of issues for the manager, for example, because, well, you know, so-and-so's not hitting so well. I'll give Lagares a night off because he's not hitting, and he can ride the bench for a while. But it's going to work on the guy's brain that he's there because he's not doing well, or he really wants to be out there and continue to press to try to make sure that his skills do stay with him.
It's certainly a balance for a manager and for the coaching staff of when do you give a guy a break so that he can kind of clear his head and reset and go back out there, and how do you present it to him versus, and this happens a lot in baseball, managers and the front office sticking with the player because they think that they're going to reach their past performance, and there's no sport that past performance is a better predictor of future success than baseball. It's amazing how over the course of 162 games, guys are who they are. They are who they are from year to year once they get established. However, the route that they get there might be different. They might be hot in April 1 year and not get hot until July the following year. But managers definitely have to balance and read their guys, like when do they really need a break, and that, do they need to be told, hey, I'm going to give you this day off, but you're going to be back in there tomorrow because we believe in you. We just need you to breathe a little bit.
Well, and then when I think about starting pitchers, and again, Doug Fister was the starting pitcher on the Nationals that you profiled here. It reminds me of guys like Matt Harvey, and he's not the only one by a long shot, who you just see them arguing with the manager, don't take me out of the game. Let me finish this inning. I mean, you can read lips well enough in baseball broadcast now to see when the pitcher goes, come on, when the manager shows up with the hook. So, I mean, how do you get people off the field and try to keep them rested well enough to do this right?
Well, that's just competition. I mean, that is most of the time in those situations, if there's an argument on the mound and a pitcher is believing he should be left in to get one more out or face one more batter, by the time they cool off and they're back in the clubhouse and they understand what happened next and what the reasons were, it oftentimes is not that big of a deal. I mean, pitch counts are a big thing in baseball now. You're not going to see guys throw 140 pitches in a start, and managers have to evaluate that not only on a given night, how many pitches has he thrown, what sort of duress has he been under, what's the strain on him in that given night, but how does that fit into the tail of the whole season? How many pitches has he thrown over the whole season? What has he done in previous seasons? What sort of position are we putting him in to succeed or fail over the rest of the season?
Barry Sraluga from the Washington Post, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Grind, Inside Baseball's Endless Season. We have an email here from Scott, no town given. He writes, I'd be a lot more sympathetic if players were still being paid the relatively low amounts they received up until the 1970s, when except for a few all-stars, playing baseball was essentially a middle-class occupation, even lower middle class in some cases. Today, with the MLB minimum salary of over $500,000, I don't think it is too much to expect that ball players play 162 games before they're 3-plus months off when they don't have too much to do except go to the gym. I'm sure you heard that just a few times in your travels, Barry.
Yeah, I don't, I think that's absolutely fair, and I think that's one of the reasons that we don't hear these stories very often. First of all, I don't think that any of them players are considering this a complaint. It's much more just a reality, and they know how well compensated they are, and they realize that in almost every case they're living out their dreams. So the book was not designed as some sort of ode to the poor, poor baseball player. It really was designed to show what goes into a major league season. And you know, we've talked a lot about the on-field stuff here, but there's really more in the book about the off-field stuff and people that not only what players do off the field mentally and physically to prepare, but other characters that are essential to the operation of a franchise, scouts and wives and the general manager, and how the everyday schedule affects everybody that they come into contact with. I think players are really reluctant to say, oh man, we've got this trip coming up that has this annoying flight and we're not going to get in until 5 in the morning. They don't say that publicly often because they know they're the fortunate ones, and it would sound like and actually would be undue, unfair complaining.
You mentioned the people off the field involved in the story as well, and the profiles of families are really compelling. I mean, do most of the guys on the Nationals, for example, have their families with them during the season?
It goes both ways. Yes, most will come for the summer. It really depends on the age of the kids and what they've got going on in the summers. And you know, I mean, right now there are only two Nationals who live in Washington full year round. Ryan Zimmerman and Jason Wirth and raise their kids there year round. Everybody else, and this is typical. I mentioned Washington because that's where I focused on. But this is really typical of all 30 major league clubs. Guys tend to live in Florida or Arizona, where they can work out and play golf in the off season, or in their hometowns, wherever that might be, Wisconsin or you know, ballplayers are from all over. So that's a weird sort of dynamic, and it creates a weird setup for families that are, you know, a lot of times young kids being asked to do strange things because their dads have strange schedules. It's a very unusual existence.
Well, and I think if I'm right about this, that baseball at least is giving guys at least time off to go watch their kids be born, or at least get there soon afterward. I think it was just last week we had both John Neese and Zach Greinke in the Mets Dodgers series either taking off to or coming back from paternity leave.
Yes, there is now a paternity leave. This is a new development. It's sort of a way to get baseball out of kind of a very antiquated way of thinking. I mean, David Murphy of the Mets took some heat. I think it was last spring because he was taking time off for paternity leave right at the beginning of the season, and some Mets fans were not happy. And when fans are not happy in those cases, they often go back to, well, you're making this X amount of money, like, don't you owe it to us to be out there? I really think that kind of takes away from the fact that these are real people with real lives, and there's nothing bigger than the birth of your children, and whether you're making $30,000 or $3 million, that is a major thing. And giving a guy 2 days off to go see his child be born is a pretty small, small sliver of the season.
The home life, when they do have families nearby living with them in town, I mean, does it make it easier? I have to believe it makes it somewhat easier for them to just kind of leave it at the office. You know, if they had a bad night on the baseball field, at least they got a family to go home to and decompress for a few hours.
The wife I followed in the book is Chelsea Desmond, the wife of national shortstop Ian Desmond, and Ian and Chelsea have known each other since they were in fifth grade, and they're raising now three small boys. It was two at the time I was reporting this, and they had another one last fall, and they're really trying to do it in a way that they are able to stick together as a family. So Chelsea doesn't spend the season at all back at their home in Sarasota, Florida, where they grew up. She comes with Ian and the boys north to Washington when the season begins, and they adjust their schedule completely. Chelsea spends spring training taking the boys from an off-season sleeping schedule when they're kind of up, during the day and go to bed early like most young kids would, and shifts them in half-hour increments to a night schedule so that they can stay up and be at the ballpark at 11 o'clock or midnight when their dad gets off work. And then they have a little bit of family time on their way home and before they go to bed at home. And then they get up later than most normal people would. They get up at 10 in the morning and have another couple hours with Ian before he goes back to work at 1 o'clock. So it's a very small thing, but I think it's really telling as to what the kind of logistical challenges are for a baseball family to kind of maintain some sense of normalcy.
It's nice to see the stuff you report in here as well about what baseball wives have done for each other. Tell us about Lori Ann Keel and how she's helped out other baseball wives.
Yeah, this is another thing you don't really hear about because, again, I don't think any of these baseball families want to come off as complaining in any way because they know that their paychecks afford them solutions that other people don't have. However, there does need to be some sort of support network because no one knows what it's like when your husband is traded mid-season and he has to be, instead of in Chicago, in Washington the very next day, never to see that apartment in Chicago or that home in Chicago again because he no longer has a life in Chicago. The wives are left to pick up the car and the dog and the house and the kids and pack them up and figure out some way to get to the new city or go home and regroup and then meet their husband slash dad in the next city and try to find new housing and perhaps new schools and babysitters and all the infrastructure that if you live in a town for years on end, you have that sort of support, you have that sort of system that you know. Again, not a complaint, but a reality that baseball wives are really only understood by other baseball wives, and it's hard to see what their lives are like from the outside.
Okay, and acknowledging again, these are people who make a lot of money and are lucky to be where they are.
Correct.
Talented as well, though, too. I wonder what some of the other wear and tear in relationships is like. I mean, is the divorce rate slightly higher or at all in baseball than it is?
Well,
in the
yeah.
Of-
I mean, I don't know that there's been a study on the divorce rate, but Chelsea Desmond was quite frank she would have been a minor league girlfriend traveling from driving in a car from behind the team bus from, you know, out of Lynchburg, Virginia to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina in Class A ball and trying to keep up with Ian and maintain some sort of long distance relationship there. And she was frank. She said, you know, when you're dating a baseball player, when you're married to a baseball player, all you hear is he's cheating on you, he's cheating on you, he's cheating on you. So to survive the season and to really have a normal relationship takes a tremendous amount of trust and a tremendous amount of work on both members of the couple.
You mentioned the minor leagues, which brings up the chapter on Tyler Moore, the 26th man, the guy who's in AAA just waiting to be the next guy back onto the Washington Nationals bench. This must be even harder, though, because they're traveling all sorts of places, probably by bus a lot of the time. And plus, he's got to stay sharp enough to be ready for the major league team when called.
Yeah, and what you find when you delve into this aspect of it is that there's not a player who wants to be in AAA baseball. It is the level of the sport that is kind of that never land in between. You know, at AA, you're still kind of a prospect on the rise, and in the majors, you've made it. And so many of the players at AAA have been to the big leagues. They know what it's like up there, and therefore they can contrast it to their day-to-day existence on bus trips between Pawtucket, Rhode Island, and Scranton, Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. And in the Pacific Coast League, it's even worse because you're playing a game until 10 or 10:30 at night, and then you've got a commercial flight at 6 a.m. The next day. There's huge distances between the franchises in those leagues. And there's a practical element there. I mean, people talk about the money these guys make. Well, they make it at the major league level, and the previous emailer was correct. The major league minimum salary is more than $500,000 a year. But if you're toggling between the majors and the minors, that is a real-life issue. Every day in the majors, you're making a prorated version of that $500,000. You go back to the minors, you're making $12,000 to $14,000 a month. There's a huge difference in impact on your family when you spend half a season in the minors because you're waiting for that next chance, and that takes a mental toll, too.
Well, it's an eye-opening book, even for people who don't particularly love baseball. Baseball lovers will get a lot out of it. It's called The Grind, Inside Baseball's Endless Season. Barry Sferluga from The Washington Post wrote it and joined us here. Barry, thanks.
Thanks so much, Jeffrey. Appreciate it.